The hour 10:15 have arrived to call the House Tax Committee to order. We have a full agenda today. We do have a quorum, so we're set to go. Let's start off with Chairman Nash. We're very fortunate today to have Chairman Nash with us. I will move House File 926, and the motion will be to lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. I will now move the DE2 amendment. Chairman Nash, is that your amendment?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, I'll move the DE2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill in the shape the author would like. Chairman Nash, let's move some minutes here first. Representative Smith moves the April 1st minutes. Excuse, Greg Dance? I guess he said there's no excuse, huh? Okay, Representative Smith moves April 1st minutes. Any additions or corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Smith. Okay, two-year bill as amended, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to be in front of you here in taxes today. House File 926 as amended is a bill that seeks to fix kind of a hiccup as it relates to wholesaling in the cigar industry. And if you're not familiar with it, when a wholesaler purchases cigars from the manufacturer and brings them into the state of Minnesota, under law they are taxed up front for those cigars. And as a wholesaler of any product, could be shoes, it could be golf balls, as the chairman would like, it could be any other thing, not everything that is brought into the wholesaler is actually sold to people in the state of Minnesota. And what happens as a result of that is the tax that's collected up front on the cigars has to be refunded down the line, because if they are sold to somebody in Iowa or Wisconsin or pick a state, the state of Minnesota is not actually owed those taxes, and wholesalers will then submit a request to have that money refunded to them. And very often, Mr. Chair and committee members, that time frame that refund is executed can be months. And in fact, earlier this month or late last month, I was on a phone call with a wholesaler who had submitted a request for a refund in I think June of last year and had just gotten it in March. So this bill was worked on with Commissioner Marquardt and his staff, and they all recognize that not only is this a fair thing to do, but it also may on the back end reduce the time that's expended by the department in issuing refunds. So this is all about fairness, and this is all about speed of getting the money back to people. So this is modeled after a law in Illinois and was worked on with the department. Mr. Chair, I do have some testifiers. If we could call them forward, that would be most helpful to talk about why this is necessary.
Okay. First of all, is there anyone who wishes to testify on behalf of the bill other than the Nash testifiers? Is there anyone that has concerns about the bill? Would the department like to weigh in at this point? That would be awesome. Yeah. So if you want to go up there and take a chair there, how many testifiers do we have on behalf of the bill?
45.
Okay. Now, what this means,
I'm kidding, Mr. Chair,
is since there's no one with concerns, a 10-minute speech goes to about 30 seconds in this committee, just so you know, because, you know, I don't know how many people in this committee have ever read the book. It's a beginning sales book when you get into sales. I think it's Don Sheehan. It's Shut Up and Sell. When you got the deal.
I'm doing my best.
You're awesome. You're awesome. To your testifier, take all the time you'd like. Let's go with the testifier first, then we'll have the department weigh in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and members of this opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill and amendment. My name is Angela Ferboni. I'm one of the owners of Founders Cigar Company. We're a veteran-owned Minnesota-based cigar fulfillment and distribution company. I'm an off-the-chart extrovert, so I prepared a statement to be succinct today. We store, ship, and fulfill orders for boutique cigar brands across the country, many of whom rely on us to legally and efficiently move their products across state lines. I'm here today in support of this bill because it's not about avoiding Minnesota's tobacco tax. It's about applying that tax fairly and logically. As it stands, we are required to pay Minnesota's tobacco tax upfront on every cigar that enters our warehouse, regardless of whether it's ever sold in the state, and in most cases it isn't. Since launching our fulfillment operation, we've made 1,528 total shipments. Only 207 of those stayed in the state of Minnesota. For one of our clients, we've made 105 shipments, and just 6 of those remained in the state to a single individual. This means that the Minnesota's taxing inventory was never intended to be sold here, and in doing so, it's creating unnecessary financial and administrative burdens for small businesses like mine. To give you a real example, I currently have cigars in our humidor that we received in December of 2022. Cigars that we already paid tobacco tax on, even though they have not been sold, are still sitting in storage, destined for out-of-state customers. On top of that, the refund process for cigars that leave the state is manual and time-consuming and inefficient. After paying thousands in taxes on large inbound shipments, as most of our shipments are large to come from the Dominican Republic, we spend hours filing paperwork and exchanging documents with the states and hoping in getting that money back, a process that can drag on for months and creates unnecessary backlogs for both the business and Department of Revenue. This bill solves that problem. It's modeled after what Illinois already implemented successfully, a simple fix that allows wholesalers like myself to store cigars exempt if they're documented and destined for out-of-state sale. It doesn't change the tax rate, doesn't create a loophole. It just aligns the timing and application of the tax. We are a small business trying to grow responsibly. In the last couple of years, we've lost several prospects to do fulfillment because of that upfront tax burden on the small business that we would be doing the fulfillment for. This bill would give us the flexibility to do that while keeping jobs, infrastructure, and economic activity here in Minnesota. This is a practical, pro-small business update that keeps Minnesota competitive while still honoring the state's tax requirements. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the testifier from members? Okay, then let's go to the department.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joanna Bears. I'm the legislative director for the Department of Revenue. And although we don't have a policy position on this, we do appreciate the author reaching out to us to help us so that we could work on this bill with him. We think it's in a good shape of where we can administer, address a lot of our concerns with the original language. So we just appreciate that he reached out. We were able to work something out.
Well, Ms. Bears, it'd be allowable to take a position on this bill. Oh, your boss, I'm sorry. No, you know, you're fine. You're fine. Thank you for the testimony. Any other questions for the department or the testifier? Anybody else from the audience like to testify for the bill or with concerns? Chair Nash, that means you get to wrap it up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really about the cash flow and fairness that the folks that are in this industry are trying to achieve. The state will still get this exact same amount of money that they've always gotten, and if in reality, in the practice of this, they will save money in meaningless paperwork and bouncing checks back and forth between the wholesalers and the state. So I appreciate your time, Mr. Chair.
No, thank you, Chair Nash. We appreciate your time. And so I'll renew my motion that House File 926, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the marvelous omnibus tax bill that is about to come before us. So with that, very exciting day today, other than the cigars, of course. They're exciting. But we will go now to the governor's proposed tax bill. And I believe there's an amendment. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so I will move House File, and this is a Davis Gomez bill. I'll move House File 2437. I will now move the 825-0042 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like it. Any discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Got that myself. That was awesome. Okay, so with that, we now have the governor's proposed tax bill as amended before us. And members, you have quite a few different, a lot of information regarding it in your packets. So we'll just start out. We're very fortunate today to have Commissioner Marquardt here. Feels like old home week, huh? So if you could please state your name, who you represent, and present your bill, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Paul Marquardt, the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, and joined here at the table by Madeline Clark, a legislative coordinator. So thank you so much for allowing me to present Governor Walz, Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's tax bill portion of the budget. It's an honor to be able to present this, and I want to thank Chair Davids and Chair Gomez for authoring the governor's tax bill today. So in light of very tough budget times, this is a responsible and practical tax bill. It really looks to create a more fair and stable tax system while also creating economic development and new jobs. There's also some things you'll see in here that are kind of past due items that have been around for a couple sessions that we're also addressing in this bill. So you see here that this tax bill is part of the overall governor's budget. The governor's budget cuts about one half of the 28-29 structural imbalance, which is almost $4 billion. The governor's overall budget cuts almost $2 billion, and the tax portion of it is part of that. So if we could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to go in order of the bill by article. Some of these you have already heard. Some of these we've already discussed. And so I'm going to probably move quicker on some. But, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, feel free to stop me at any time. So the first one actually is Article 1, Sustainable Aviation Fuel Policy. This is the exact same language as House File 1669 is amended that you heard in this committee. So the committee is well aware of this. I will just add that this really is a great opportunity not only to spur the economy around the state, especially in rural areas, but also to create cleaner aviation fuels. Article 1, repeal the K-12 education credit assignment, another bill you have talked about before. I just want to assure that all this does is eliminates the assignment portion of the K-12 credit. It does not impact any other part of the bill. And right now, about less than 1% actually use the assignment. So it is just eliminating the assignment part, but the rest of the credit stays intact. New from the last time I was here is this next one, eliminate the political contribution refund. That was part of the governor's supplemental budget that he produced on March 21st. Next is to expand the research and development credit. Governor Walz talking to a lot of businesses, and this really was a top priority that came forward, was creating some refundability on the research and development credit. So what this does in the governor's bill here is this has a refundability of 25%. So any excess beyond the tax liability that isn't being used on that credit, up to 25% of that is refundable. And all other laws apply. There's no other changes there. There was an OLA report in 2017. This does address some of those concerns in looking at a study that would look at its effectiveness and so forth, and also looking at purpose statements. On the next slide is just a little more information. I mean, part of it is Minnesota was a leader. I think the federal R&D credit started in 1981, and that's the year Minnesota, we were the first state to have an R&D credit. And it is a tax cut of about $20 million a year. It will benefit about 500 corporations and 100 pass-through entities. And one thing to remember, I think, about the R&D credit is that it's more than probably just jobs, in the fact that an owner will never receive or never kind of appreciate the full benefits of the societal benefits that research and development provides to its citizens. They never probably see that. And then also with research and development, with patents and other things, that they don't have sole kind of ownership of that forever. And so some of the costs of R&D are never fully appreciated from the company doing that for those reasons. Short line railroad infrastructure modernization. This is kind of a holdover from last session. and basically allows a transfer, but instead of having to wait to the end of the tax year, you can do it immediately. This one, probably a little bit new from the last time I was here. It was not in the tax portion of this, and it's it deals with the airport fund levy. So right now there's a state airport fund that it's about $26.7 million a year that funds infrastructure projects, airports around the state, but also funds part of MnDOT's aeronautics office. And the way it works right now is there's like four funding streams that come into the state airport fund. And like I said, it's over $26 million. One of them is this kind of airport levy, if you will. And that number of 26 million stays fixed. So this levy kind of moves up or down depending on how the other three revenue sources coming in. So if the other revenue sources come in higher, that levy goes lower. If the other three come in lower, that revenue goes higher. So what this bill does, it decouples from that, and instead of basically having about a $7 million levy, it'll be set at 8.05%. The idea is, overall, they want to pump up the state airport fund by about 10%, by about $2.65 million, and this is part of that. So it's just kind of decoupling, and then would raise it from kind of what the average is usually, from about $7 million to $8.05 million a year on the property tax. The next one is the very popular attachments and appurtenances, and this is one that's, I don't know if it's two sessions or three sessions or more. This is one that's been around for a while, but hopefully we can get this one done this year. Basically, replaces attachments and appurtenances with distribution systems. The next one, I know you heard a bill within the last couple of weeks on this one. That's the personal property exception for low-income housing. And while the bill you heard was more expansive than this one just deals with one issue. It just makes sure that the tenants don't get a personal property tax. That's all this one does. Doesn't deal with classification rates or anything else. It just kind of settles the issue on there won't be any personal property tax for the tenants. Otherwise, it would be pretty significant if they had to. Also, of course, because the tenants would not pay, there'd be no renter's credit also that would impact any of this either. Next, reduce aquatic invasive species aid. That's moving the funding to the counties from $10 million to $5 million. One thing to remember here is that the governor is not reducing the program. He is reducing the funding. And as I say that, much of the funding, so this goes to the county, but much of it is actually implemented by lake associations, lake improvement districts, and so forth. And in fact, lake improvement districts can levy their own taxes with county approval. So while he is certainly reducing the funding, he is not in any way, shape, or form impacting the importance or the program. And that still is very much there and very much supported by the governor. This one is new, a reduced payment in lieu of taxes. This was also the second item, and this was part of the amendment you added today, was the 34% reduction in PILT payments. So right now, those payments are about $48 million a year. This would move that back to about $31 million a year, which would be at about 2015 levels. So Article 3, I'd like to move to the sales tax. And so there's a number of slides here, and you know we've talked about this before. This is a long overdue improvement to the tax code. And there you see the benefits. We've talked about this before. It creates more tax fairness because we're taxing a lot of other services currently. Our economy is becoming more service orientated from when the sales tax was enacted in 1967, when it was about 60% goods, 40% services. It's now pretty much flipped. So it's trying to right size and gather more of the economy, which Hopefully you can lower rates if you expand the base. We know the sales tax is a more stable tax than income and corporate. And there's also strong evidence in literature and so forth that adding services, especially these more select ones that the governor is doing with the professional services, will make the sales tax less regressive. So it would make it more progressive. It still remains regressive, but it will make it more progressive and therefore less regressive. So let's just take a look at it here. So I'm going to concentrate on a few areas, one at a time. And one, it does lower the statewide sales tax rate by 0.075%. So it would lower the rate from, in effect, from 6.875 to 6.8. It's actually 6.425 to 6.5 because the legacy 0.375% isn't touched. So you're just hitting that base rate. Would be the first sales tax cut in state history. And what's important here is business-to-business sales remain exempt. So if I have a farm business and I hire an accountant, that's business-to-business, it's income-producing, that this is not added to those taxes. And a lot of the past proposals that have really expanded going to services have included the business-to-business taxes. And I think that's where they've really had difficulties. Not to say that this won't either, but you know, the fact is when you go business to business, you are really taxing inputs and equipment and so forth, and that really creates what we call tax pyramiding and really passes those costs on to consumers. So individuals and businesses will get a tax cut, and I'll give you a little more data on that later, but the average household we'll see an annual tax cut of about $32 because of a rate cut. That is if they don't use any of the expanding services. Now, the last time I was here, I had an average family, and it was $37 because that income's a little higher and they spend a little more. But when I had house research look at, can you dig into the data? Because I think it was Representative Anderson that asked me to come back with kind of a little more data on how this worked. And on a slide here coming up, I'll show you that. And they ended up doing it with average household income. So that's why this number has changed a little bit. And we'll get into that. But the other thing, too, is that if you're a business, because we're not doing business to business, you will see the benefit entirely of the rate cut. And so materials and supplies, general items, you look at construction like of homes or things. You know, although you buy a bulldozer, excavator, forklifts, lumber, all of that, for these big projects, companies would see the benefit of that rate cut. Also important to know that this rate cut does not impact local sales taxes, the legacy fund, or any of those new metro sales taxes. Now, it does expand the base because the base will expand for those, but the if you got a half-cent local sales tax, that doesn't change, but the base will. So it may help cities and counties pay off their bonds earlier because they'll come in a little quicker, which could save some costs there. And it also adds about $12 million a year to the legacy fund. Because of the expansion there, too. So next slide, please. Currently taxed services, I just give you an example that we already tax many, and there's the situations also that we tax. One thing you're going to hear is that anytime you move, especially on services versus goods, goods are certainly more clear-cut, services a little more difficult. But it's not like we haven't done that in the past. And if you go on to the Department of Revenue website, you look at these sales tax facts, and it's literally alphabetized A to Z, and it's just pages. So it can become more cumbersome, but we can do it. So, you know, if we're going to tax these new services, yes, there'll be a little time in looking at things, but we've done it in the past. It's not like this is the first time this would be done. And I would say also, because I know I was hoping, Mr. Chair, that the room was filled for Chairman Nash's bill and not this one. So you're going to hear a number of testifiers, and I just want you to know that the governor wants to listen. So, I mean, if there's concerns here and so forth, we want you know, we're listening here on all sorts of things and to make this work. Just want to make that.
Well, Commissioner Marquardt, they were all here for the Nash bill, but the Minnesota Nice are polite and they don't want to walk out in the middle of your presentation.
Mr. Chair, I understand that. So the next one then is looking at the where the expansion is. It's right sizing the sales tax to match our service economy. It's accounting, banking and brokerage, legal services. What we have there is what's in the statute, kind of what I have listed there. But and these are selected services. So you say, well, why did you select these? Well, basically, if you take business to business off, which are the largest ones that aren't taxed right now, and look at these consumer, the other ones are personal services like haircuts, funeral services, and then automobile repair and maintenance. And this one certainly, the ones we on professional are more select versus the other ones. But I would say, because I know there will be questions on this, that you'll look at this and say, well, is it taxed or not? Here's what I would assume, that unless it's excluded, which is on the next page, I would assume that it's taxable. Just assume that it's taxable. Now, just because it is doesn't mean a business has to tax it. For example, I looked at my own bank in Dilworth on what they, the only thing they really tax is a service charge of $10 a month if you go below $100, I think, on your minimum balance. Otherwise, free checking, free ATM cards, all this stuff is free. And some banks may charge. But just because it's on this list doesn't mean they have to charge, and many may not. And in fact, it may create more competition as people realize, hey, I'm getting taxed for this, but you're not, and so forth. So that's just something to keep in mind. And again, we want to hear folks and what they have to say on that. Next one are items that are excluded. A lot of these certainly are policy choices. But those are the items, and we've talked about that before, that are exempt. Probably the biggest one is tax preparation for claiming the child tax credit and the working family credit would be still exempt, excluded. Bank origination fees are probably a big one. So we'll get to the next slide. They'll look at the total. Oh, by the way, these are effective for sales and purchases made after September 30th of 2025. And, you know, that date can always be changed. If that would be a concern, it would affect certainly the revenue note a little bit on when that would start. So the last slide I have here is kind of an analysis of the sales tax proposal and the impact on individual taxpayers. So the total sales tax rate cut, and I'm using fiscal year 27 because that's the first full year that it's in effect. Is $99 million. That rate cut, 0.075, is about $99 million in that first year. The total service expansion in that first year is $215 million. So that's where the revenue is gained in this part, in about $116 million a year. But here's where I think we're really confident in saying a good majority of individuals will see a tax cut under the proposal. And here's why, and I had the Department of Research, the Revenue Research, look at this. And so, first of all, if you look at legal services expansions, $124 million, 58% of the expansion. So most of it's going to be right there. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics Federal Consumer Expenditure Survey, and research says less than 10% of an average household will use legal services. So you got less than 10% taking up 58%. So take away that 10%. The rest of the 90%, if you look at accounting and financial, is $91 million. So if you look at the rest, you have a $99 million cut and a $91 expansion. Actually, on the rest of that 90%, there's actually overall an $8 million tax cut. Now, you wouldn't say 90% are going to get tax cut. So let's move to the next one. You move below, average household will see an annual sales tax cut. Broken down further, the annual household will see a cut of about $32, 1.8%. And then the expansion is $73. If you look further, the accounting service, or the legal, is $42. So it leaves like $31 for the other two. And they say accounting services about 25% of the households. We'll use that, and on the other one, likely higher. So let's say they use both. And let's say accounting services is 25% and the other one's 30, whatever that might be. So let's say 30% use the rest. And you know it's close. It's $32 cut to a $31 expansion. And at $32, you can spend up to $470 and you still come out ahead. It's because that $470 at 6.8% is $32 tax. So you can spend up to $470 and still see a tax cut. If you pay over $470, you would see a tax increase. So let's say it says it's close. Let's say you split it in half. That half pay up to $470, the other because it's $32.31. So now you got another 15% that would see a tax increase. Plus, let's say assume that all 10%, we'll say it's 10% that use legal sees a tax increase. That's probably about 25%. That probably have a tax increase. And quite frankly, I think you could argue that up to 75% of folks in a given year would see a tax cut. Now, the conclusions are mine, not Department of Revenue Research. They just gave me the stats and let me work with that. But I think when you look at that, because these are select services, if these services hit everyone 100%, yes, then you've got it. But the fact is, and that's why the governor really selected these professional services, is because they are more select, and they probably have also more wiggle room to adjust their rates than others would. So I'm gonna. So I mean, I think it's safe to say that a good majority of folks would enjoy a tax cut under this proposal. All right. So I'm gonna move quickly on the rest. I know, Mr. Chair, because we've got folks that want to go here. So landlord penalty, we've talked about that before. It used to be $100 if they didn't get it to a tenant. Now they have to provide some to the Department of Revenue, and now it's 50-50. So the penalty didn't go up, but 50% would go, because now since we moved it from a refund to a credit, we want to get those certificates of rent paid electronically to the Department of Revenue so we can compare it to the tax form and so forth. So not an increase, just split differently. Reducing sustainable forest incentive payments by 30%. A part here is that if you were in one of these covenants agreements, you can withdraw by July 1st of 26 without any penalty. Repeal local government cannabis aid. We've talked about that before. The county's got a little bit. None had yet gone out to cities. Finally, repeal the tax filing modernization account. So I will say right on the front that the Department of Revenue is very open still to doing a direct file. We just want to make sure that if we do it, we're doing it right from the start. And right now there's questions as far as the federal treasury. They said they would keep it going this year, but going to study it in the future. And also ongoing funding would be required, so from the legislature. So, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and members, thank you so much for allowing me to present the governor's tax bill.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Before we go to questions from members, if the department could please stick around, I think we need to get to public testimony, and then we will, if we have time, we'll come back for member questions. So thank you so much, Commissioner Marquardt. So we have quite a list, and when we have a list like this, we go out other than the commissioner or Department of Revenue folks, we go like 2 minutes apiece. So if you have a 4 minute speech, just throw one page away and keep the other one. That's how it works. So let's go to, okay, Joanna Bears, but you have already talked a little bit here. So let's go to Kyle Playford, and then on deck, Gail Mikulich, and then in the hole, Roz Peterson. So let's go with Mr. Playford first, and if the others could get up there too, Ms. Mikulich from Northeast Bank, and then Ms. Peterson. And then if that will be Ryan Pervenans. Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir. 2 minutes.
Yes. Thank you. My name is Kyle Playford, and I represent the Financial Planning Association of Minnesota. And I'm also a financial planner for Freedom Financial Partners, a local independent registered investment advisor in Oakdale. The Minnesota Financial Planning Association is the leading professional organization for financial planners in the state. Our mission is to advance the financial planning profession and support Minnesotans in achieving their financial goals through ethical and competent financial guidance. The Minnesota chapter of the Financial Planning Association strongly opposes the proposed sales tax on professional services, including financial planning. This tax would create significant financial burdens for Minnesota families and businesses, making it more expensive for individuals to gain access for financial guidance that they need to plan for their futures. Financial planning is not a luxury. It is a critical service that helps Minnesotans navigate complex financial decisions, prepare for retirement, manage investments, and secure their financial well-being. Adding a sales tax to these essential services would increase costs for consumers, potentially pricing out those who need financial advice the most, including middle-class families, small business owners, and retirees. Additionally, this taxation would place Minnesota firms at a competitive disadvantage. Many financial planning clients have the flexibility to seek services across state lines, which could lead to lost business for Minnesota-based firms and ultimately impact the state's economy. At a time when financial literacy and long-term financial security are more important than ever, policies should encourage access to financial planning services, not create barriers to obtaining them. We urge state lawmakers to consider alternative revenue sources that do not jeopardize the financial stability of Minnesotans or place unnecessary strain on businesses that provide essential financial services. The Minnesota chapter of the Financial Planning Association remains committed to advocating for policies that support financial wellness and economic growth in our state. Thank you for your time and the opportunity.
And thank you, sir. And members, we're going to go through all the testimony and then we'll come back with questions. So if the people that are testifying could stick around for the rest of me, that'd be great. Thank you so much, Mr. Playford. And please stick around because I've got a lot of questions for Matt Hilgard. Would be a lot of questions. Ms. Mikulich, please state your name, who you represent for the record, please.
Yes, Chair Davids, Chair Gomez, and members. I'm Gail Mikulich, Chief Operating Officer of Northeast Bank in Minneapolis. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to the committee today on behalf of my bank and the Minnesota Bankers Association. Northeast Bank is a community bank based in Northeast Minneapolis with branches in New Brighton and Coon Rapids. Northeast Bank was established in 1947 by a handful of local business people who believed banking services were essential to the success of their community. We are concerned about Article 3, Section 1 of the bill, which expands the sales tax to additional services. Specifically, we are opposed to requiring banks to collect sales tax on certain bank fees. We believe this will have a negative impact on our customers. This amendment to the sales tax statutes is not a tax on services, it is a tax on fees. Some fees are for specific services and some are not. This bill does not make a distinction. This is not a tax on the wealthy, it is a tax on nearly every Minnesotan because banking is an essential service. According to the FDIC, 96% of U.S. households have a bank account. It's a big change to go from assessing sales tax on optional services to charging sales tax on a fee that is part of an essential service. Adding cost to bank customers could have unintended consequences of keeping more lower-income Minnesotans out of the banking system. One-third of unbanked households cite fees or minimum balance as the main reason for not having an account. It may also encourage part-time Minnesota residents to move their deposits out of Minnesota, impacting the ability to make loans. If the state does charge sales tax on banking services, the legislature or the Department of Revenue will need to precisely define which banking services are taxable and which ones are not. The language in the current bill states that the tax applies to, quote, banking and brokerage services, including but not limited to five specific banking services. That language is far too ambiguous. Finally, the effective date of this section is September 30th, 2025. Banks need more time to comply with this new tax provision. Banking products and services are not currently taxable, so we do not have sales tax software programs connected to our bank's core processing systems. It will take time to acquire and implement the necessary software programs needed to comply with this new tax provision. Thank you for allowing me to testify today.
And thank you so much for your testimony. I will go with Ms. Peterson, and then we'll go to Mr. for Vinans, and then Mr. Hansen with the business partnership, and then Michael Dahl. So please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, chairs and members, for the opportunity to provide feedback on Governor Walz's budget proposal regarding the expansion of the sales tax in House File 2437. My name is Roz Peterson, and I serve as the Public Policy Director for NAIOP, the Commercial Real Estate Development Trade Association, representing over 600 members in Minnesota. We have significant concerns that expanding the sales tax to include services such as accounting, legal, title searches, banking, and investments will have a detrimental impact on the people of Minnesota. While the legislation exempts business-to-business transaction, it's important to recognize that most small businesses are structured as pass-through entities, like LLCs, sole proprietors, or subchapter S corporations. These businesses file taxes through individual returns, which would be subject to the sales tax. Considering that the addition of local taxes on top of the state rate, the effective rate in the metro area could reach over 9% or more. This increased tax burden could push businesses and individuals to seek professional services outside of Minnesota, ultimately reducing demand for local expertise and harming the state's economy. And let's not forget that many of these tenants are in our buildings, and Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bloomington market leads the country in the highest distress rate at 49.7%. Furthermore, these professional services already contribute through income taxes, making this an additional financial strain on consumers and businesses alike. Moreover, this is a regressive tax that disproportionately impacts those who can least afford it. Making essential professional services more expensive will hurt small businesses and everyday Minnesotans. We'd urge you to carefully consider these unintended consequences and seek alternative solutions that do not place an undue burden on Minnesota's businesses and residents. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much, Ms. Peterson. And Ms. Peterson is a former member of this House. Let's go to Ryan, and then let's see if Gavin can come up, and Michael Dahl, please. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Ryan Pervenanzi, speaking on behalf of Carlton County and their Board of Commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity, and you know, on behalf of the county, we respect, you know, the work that the legislature is doing, as well as the governor's office and the commissioner on, you know, a challenging budget cycle. But I would just like to make a few brief comments on the PILT portion of the governor's budget. In Carlton County, about 28% of our land qualifies for PILT coverage, which is a significant portion, and the proposed reduction will have a major hit on our county, probably upwards of $200,000, $212,000, I think is the last number that I came up with. So it is a big deal for a smaller county with, you know, roughly 35,000 people. So we just ask that the members take that into consideration, because, you know, that reduction in our revenue really has a detrimental effect. You know, unfortunately, Carlton County has the distinction of one of the highest tax counties in the state of Minnesota, which we're working on, but, you know, the lack of developable land in our county is difficult. You know, I can point to one of our cities which, you know, has basically 60% of their taxable base covered by state-owned land, being the city of Moose Lake. So, I mean, it really is a challenge for smaller counties, and especially our northern counties, to deal with reductions in PILT. But again, we just wanted to come down here and make sure that our voices are heard, you know, not only Carlton County, but I know it affects, you know, a bunch of, especially our northern counties. And I just want to thank you for the opportunity and appreciate all the work that you are doing. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
And thank you very much, sir. Let's go to Mr. Gavin Hansen, Michael Dahl, and then we're going to have O'Hilkard and Justin together. Please state your name and who represent for the record, please.
Chair Davids, Chair Gomez, and members of the committee, Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 2437, specifically Article 1, Section 7, regarding the refundable R&D tax credit. My name is Gavin Hansen, and I serve as the Fiscal and Economic Policy Director for the Minnesota Business Partnership. MBP represents more than 100 business leaders and executives whose companies collectively employ nearly 500,000 Minnesotans across a diverse range of industries, all contributing to America's headquarters economy. First, we want to thank Governor Walz for including this refundable R&D credit in his budget and for his commitment to restoring Minnesota's leadership in research and development. Minnesota is uniquely positioned to be a national leader in innovation, with world-class institutions like the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic, alongside a thriving ecosystem of companies advancing medical technology, manufacturing, aerospace, power sports, and food science. Our state has a strong foundation for R&D. Making the R&D tax credit refundable up to 25% ensures that when a company's investment in research and development exceeds its tax liability, the difference is refunded. This policy incentivizes businesses to expand their R&D efforts, leading to greater capital investment and higher quality job creation. These are precisely the kinds of jobs that every state competes for, highly skilled, well-compensated positions that drive long-term economic growth. But this policy is about more than just jobs. A refundable R&D credit sends a clear signal that Minnesota is committed to being a hub for groundbreaking innovation. Whether in life-saving medical devices, cutting-edge treatments, food sciences, outdoor power sports equipment, or other industries at the forefront of technological advancement. At the Minnesota Business Partnership, we advocate for policies that foster economic growth across the entire state. Few initiatives have the potential to drive that growth as effectively as investing in research and development. By prioritizing R&D, the Minnesota Legislature can reaffirm our state's role as a national leader in innovation. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I urge the committee to support House File 2437. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We'll go now to Michael Dahl and then Matt Hilgert and Ethan Jessen. And members, as we start looking in the spreadsheets, you do have a ruler. It's very important for me anyways to use that. So it should be in your folders. Okay, let's go with Mr. Dahl and then if we could get Matt Hilgert and Ethan Jessen up here. Mr. Dahl.
Good morning, co-chairs Davis and Gomez and members of the committee. My name is Michael Dahl and I'm the Public Policy Director at Homeline, a statewide tenant advocacy organization. Thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding the Renter's Credit Certificate of Rent Pays aspect of House File 2437. We support the measure for three reasons and have two suggestions to strengthen it. Regarding our support, first, it adds a layer of accountability for renters to receive the certificate of rent paid form from their landlords by distributing the penalty that it covers both from the tenant and the Department of Revenue. Landlords would theoretically be encouraged to meet both obligations, thereby reducing the likelihood that a tenant must submit an affidavit of rent paid to claim their renter's credit. This leads me to the second reason for Homeline support. First, I want to emphasize that most landlords and tenants are decent individuals. However, some tenants are hesitant to create friction with their landlords. Some even fear retaliation for addressing issues that their landlord is required to resolve. The accountability to the Department of Revenue creates the opportunity for the department to contact a landlord if they have not met this obligation. Homeline supports this measure also because of the calls we receive. We know that many small landlords are unaware of issuing a certificate of rent paid is one of their obligations. Once again, theoretically, the true prong approach penalty creates an opportunity for landlords to comply with the law. Now, I use the word theoretically twice. This is because in practice, many landlords are unlikely to follow a law without more outreach to inform them of the regulation. This issue needs correction, otherwise the burden always falls on the tenant. Lastly, like many tenant landlord law, the fine amounts have not increased for years. The $100 penalty is minimal. Amending the law to presents an opportunity to address this. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
And thank you very much, sir. Really appreciate your testimony. Let's go to Mr. Hilgert, Mr. Jessen, then up next would be Robert Hanton, and then Brian. You're up after that. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Matt Hilgert. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. And Mr. Chair, I would posit that as you look around today, there may be no single entity more impacted by this proposal in front of us today than counties. And you know it's bad when you go around the Capitol and random people come up to you and say, I'm so sorry, or what did you do? And let me say publicly, if I did something or counties did something, accept this as our apology, because there's a lot in this budget, and we'd love to just talk about some of those facts. And I'm going to gloss over, because of the time constraints, some of the things like AIS or cannabis aid. But I really do want to pause a little bit on PILT. The last testifier a few ago talked about this. This House has had a really strong position, and frankly, in a bicameral fashion, of supporting PILT. And we have had, as a state, an explicit and implicit, we've had an implicit understanding and an explicit contract that conservation and community resiliency go hand in hand. It is not okay for communities who shoulder a disproportionate amount of tax-exempt lands, state parks, forests, recreational areas for the state, don't have the means to support themselves financially as a community. One county commissioner from St. Louis County even said, it takes me longer time to drive to various areas of my commissioner district than it does down to St. Paul. That shows you just the vast lands and territories that we are dealing with as counties. Coochiching County, for example, just their 34% abstract PILT cut in this proposal would be $1.5 million. Their entire levy is $7 million. It's a 19.7% levy increase right off the bat for that item, just that item alone. Let's note the cumulative effects of this budget. Outside of this jurisdiction, but I appreciate the latitude of the four health and human services related cuts that total $150 million in the first biennium and $257 in the second. And that goes along with laws passed in the 2023 legislature, such as the Child Welfare Disproportionality Act that we've talked about in this committee, that we're already seeing estimates of over $100 million there without funding. So as we talk about this stacking effect of all these things, what that means for your districts is that you're going home to potential proposed levies of double digits, period, across the state as you put that. And that's before potentially talking about COLAs or anything else that we're needing to do regarding health insurance premiums or more. For Hennepin County alone, the disability waiver cost shift for them, for Hennepin County, is twice the amount of CPA increase they got in the 2023 tax bill.
Mr. That's Hillier, one of the four. If you could wrap it up, please.
So, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the latitude, but as you can see from the impassioned plea, we would ask the legislature to consider the cumulative effects of some of these proposals as you are making tough decisions in the next couple months. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll see you after class. Mr. Jessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nathan Jessen. I represent the Minnesota Inter-County Association. MICA is an organization that represents 17 of the largest counties in Minnesota outside of Hennepin and Ramsey. I just really wanted to hammer home a couple of these points. It's important to remember when we're talking about the impacts of counties in this proposed budget, we're not talking about cuts, really. We're talking about shifts. We're talking about shifts onto counties and onto county property taxpayers. I know that in 2023, the legislature passed a historic increase to CPA and LGA, and this committee had a big part in that. But that historic increase is significantly smaller than the kinds of HHS cost shifts and other cost shifts that Mr. Hillgart just discussed. You know, it's also been the executive branch has mentioned the high level of aid that goes out to cities and counties is kind of a justification for some of these proposals. But a lot of the time, the high level of aid is really just a partial reimbursement for mandates that go out to cities and counties. It's like asking for credit for giving somebody a quarter after charging them a dollar. And Mr. Hillgart talked about some of the impacts of these cost shifts, whether it's PILT or the HHS, and they represent, you know, this level of levy increase. But it's important to remember that that is just kind of the starting point. That's the new base. That's before we're talking about increases regarding wages, construction, other unfunded mandates, or inflation. So that's any time you're talking about the cost increase, that's just really the starting point. So the other thing I just mentioned is that the last time we shifted costs onto local governments to this scale was in the 2000s. Those shifts were broader, whereas these shifts are really just targeted at counties. But we saw higher property tax increases at that time than we ever have since. And the reality is that if we continue down this path, we may be headed right back there. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you know, we understand these are not easy choices, and I empathize with the difficult decisions ahead, but we really do not believe that cost shifts on this scale that this budget proposes is the best path forward. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Jessen. We'll now go to Robert Hanton, I believe the name is, and then Brian, and then Stephanie, and then Rick Horton. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Thank you for letting me testify. My name is Bob Hanton. I'm from Long Lake, Minnesota. I'm a registered investment advisor with Pilot Capital Management Corporation. And this registration allows me to manage client investments and provide financial planning for a fee. This is what is going to be taxed. I'm a past president of Minneapolis chapter of NAFA, the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, and I currently sit on their NAFA board. I oppose the provision of House File 2437 that imposes taxes on investment management fees, financial planning fees, and other services I provide. So investment management fees typically from when you have an investment account and you have an investment advisor, the fees come out of the account and then and they are tax deductible. So you don't have to pay taxes when the money comes out of an IRA. Now, with the sales tax, if that's going to be coming out of the account, and if you're under 59 and a half, you're going to have to pay taxes and a penalty on the money being used to pay for the sales tax, or you're going to have to find another way to bill it. All right, and then my question is it really advisable for the state to impose a sales tax on IRAs and investment accounts when the tax laws that had created the IRAs and the tax deferred accounts were about creating tax deferral? Tax deferral allows people to grow a nest egg to reach retirement, and a dollar spent on taxes turns into $4 in 30 years, assuming at 4%. So this is, in other words, you don't just pay the sales tax, but the sales tax will continue to not compound in the account because it's not there. That's one of the reasons we built these tax deferred accounts. And so I think this law would be a counter purposes for what the federal government was trying to do. As far as in financial planning, there is a crisis in financial planning that people don't have access to advisors and adding to the cost or adding to the complexity of billing and reporting for people is not a way to get planning into the hands of people. Because, you're creating additional work for us, the tendency would be if it's a small account, we're not going to deal with it. And it's not polite to say, but it is how businessmen think as you add on to the burden. So the American people, as they come to me, they can't tell me how much they earn. They can't tell me what their debts are. They don't know the value of their accounts. They don't even know where all of them are. They don't know how they're titled. Okay, and then they're trying to make exceedingly complex decisions, and they aren't even self-aware of their situation. And they come to us like, should I pre-tax or post-tax? Okay, well, it depends upon your bracket, which changes over time, and it's an ongoing discussion, and it's contextual. They read stuff from bloggers, and a lot of it is nonsense what applied to a person in their position. They really need financial advice. When should I take Social Security? Well, that's a really
age
difficult
70
question.
As a rule. Pardon? Age 70 is a rule, if you're healthy.
Yes, Rick. Mr. Chairman. It's a very complex thing. It takes a lot of software. It takes detailed analysis, a great depth of fact finding to really give a person the advice that's contextual, and charging them a sales tax and adding to the cost of this vital service.
Mr. Hanton, if you could please wrap it up, please.
That's it.
Oh, perfect timing. Thank you. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Chair Davis, Chair Gomez, my name is Brian Peach. I represent the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. I'm also here today giving testimony on behalf of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. Together, we represent the securities and insurance industry in the state of Minnesota and over 130,000 employees and professionals with our organizations. Many of our members are hometown companies, and as a result, we tend to have a disproportionate number of Minnesota clients. I want to just start by dispelling the myth that financial planning and advice is for the wealthy. In fact, the average person who comes to us for the first time has less than $50,000 in assets. They tend to be younger, more diverse, And they tend to be getting their financial advice from really interesting sources like friends or TikTok. And so we're very happy when they come to them. And as an example, my niece called me in her early 20s. She needed a financial safety net and told me that she had a great idea. She was going to invest in crypto and wondered what I thought about that. We connected her with a financial professional who talked to her about getting a 401k match from her employer and investing in solid, stable things so that she can have a secure retirement. Those are the sort of people that are coming to us. We're also concerned about the vague nature of the bill. The language is very wide open. In fact, one of our people said it is a compliance nightmare and an auditor's dream. Financial institutions want to comply with such things, but it's very difficult. No other state adds a tax on these sort of services. In fact, three have tried. Florida tried it years ago. They repealed it in 6 months. Michigan repealed it within 17 hours of being effective, and Massachusetts waited two whole days. So let's not go that far. I urge the committee and the members to vote against this provision. We're in a time of financial insecurity, rising prices, and uncertainty. Let's not tax people when they're coming to us needing the advice the most. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Let's go to Stephanie Pincala, Rick Horton, and then Nan Madden.
Thank you, Co-Chair Davids and Co-Chair Gomez and members of this committee for the opportunity to speak to you on House File 2437. My name is Stephanie Pincala. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Nature Conservancy, a nonprofit organization working to conserve the lands and waters on which all life depends towards our vision where people and nature thrive. I'm here to comment on two provisions that appear in the bill. First, to share our concern and opposition to Sections 4 and 7 affecting the calculation of incentive payments for the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, or SFIA, which will reduce the payment rates and allow enrollees to break their long-term covenants early as a condition of the rate change. While the Nature Conservancy is a landowner enrolled in the program and whose payments are used toward forest management efforts and would be negatively impacted by the proposal, the concern we raise today is about the overall impact of forests in the state and our ability to tackle climate change. SFIA has been a critical tool for ensuring forest cover is retained in large tracts, and science over and over again shows that the best nature-based carbon sequestration tool we have in the state is maintaining and expanding tree cover on the landscape. That starts with protecting the forests that we have. As an organization working alongside state and federal agencies and other nonprofits in Minnesota to tackle climate change, the proposal to scale back SFIA payments raises alarm bells. The impact that it would have on forest canopy in the state is significant, given enrollees are predominantly private landowners who have a myriad of reasons for enrolling in the program. Based on past budget recommendations and the climate action framework, we believe the administration is committed to addressing climate change, but reducing these payments risks the participation of landowners who are dependent on payments to partake in the program and ultimately risks the big carbon sequestration tool we have. SFIA works to store carbon and provide multiple benefits for water quality, quantity, habitat, outdoor recreation, wood products, et cetera, which have resulted in large forest tracts remaining intact, but there's significant risk for loss of forests if this proposal were to move forward. I'll briefly add, we have submitted a letter to the committee that also touches on the sustainable aviation fuel credit and the newly introduced payment in lieu of taxes proposal. I'll just add on the PILT reduction. That could have a serious chilling effect on county-based conservation and will ultimately impact the state's ability to leverage our natural lands to tackle climate change. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I was hoping that the Nature Conservancy would be supporting my bill this year, but that's the way it goes. Okay, Mr. Horton, Ann Madden, and then we'll go virtually to John Call. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Rick Horton. I represent Minnesota Forest Industries. We're the primary wood-consuming mills in the state. I'd like to start on a positive note and note that the SAF tax credit elements of the bill are important, and we support them, especially the sliding scale that's introduced based on carbon intensity, because sustainable aviation fuel made with wood has one of the lowest carbon intensities out there. So there's a lot of opportunity in that space for us, and that bill, that portion of the bill helps us. However, the remainder, so there are other elements of the bill that are really kind of an attack on northern Minnesota. They disproportionately put the pain upon the northern counties. So the PILT, we've already heard about that, but that is a big hit. Most of the northern counties have a disproportionate amount of public land, and therefore the PILT hit is going to hit them hard, and the only way they can make that money back up is by raising levies or selling more land, and we don't want to see that land get sold off and parcelized and developed. The other element that I won't touch upon is the 50% reduction in invasive aquatic species management. Again, the northern counties have some of the most pristine lakes, and where we're really trying to prevent the input of those things. But I want to focus most of my time on the reductions to the Sustainable Forest Incentives Act found in Article 4, Sections 4 and 7. SFIA is one of the most important tools that we have for incentivizing private landowners to keep their working forests working and keep them intact. When that was established, there was a worry about when budgets got tight that they would cut it. And so intentionally, 290C says that it can't go up and down by more than 10% per year. And this gives those folks that have signed long-term commitments on their land, 8-year covenants on their title, 20-year covenant, 50-year covenant, they made long-term investments and said, we will not split up our land, we will not develop on our land, and we will get a forest management plan and we'll follow it. And in return, the state will give us an annual payment. And it was not supposed to vary by more than 10%. Everybody signed the contract, and then now the state is reneging on that contract. They're changing the law first to allow it and then implementing the change. Seems very disingenuous, and I think it's going to do a lot of damage to the trust that private landowners have in state government when it comes to these land protection practices like conservation easements.
Mr. Horn, if you wrap it up, please.
I will wrap with that. I will just point out that there is a detailed letter in your packet on this issue, and it's signed by everyone from the forest products industry to the environmental community. And when we're in agreement, you might want to take note of it.
Thank you. Kind of like Farm Bureau and Farmers Union. If they're together, watch out.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We'll now go to Nan Madden, and then we'll go virtual to Mr. John Call, then we'll go to Brian Lake. Ms. Madden.
Thank you, Chair Davids, Chair Gomez, and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify today. We thank Governor Walz for a tax plan that kicks off some important conversations, including modernizing our sales tax to reflect today's economy, and how the state should raise revenues in order to protect Minnesotans' health and economic well-being in the face of federal budget cuts, both those cuts that have already occurred and the proposed drastic cuts to health care, nutrition, and funding to the states that are on the horizon. We also thank Governor Walz for including provisions to support Minnesota renters. We support the personal property tax exemption for low-income housing tenants, which would limit the substantial financial harm to renters that is arising from the Alliance Housing court case. We also appreciate the ongoing attention from this committee to find solutions that would protect tenants' access to the renter's credit as well. We also support the provision to ensure that renters receive their certificates of rent paid. This is important documentation that is essential for eligible renters to file for their renter's credit. However, we are disappointed by the proposed repeal of the tax filing modernization account and discontinuing implementation of direct file. While there is uncertainty about the long-term prospects for direct file at the federal level, we think it is too soon to back away from planning to offer Minnesotans this chance to have a free, easier, and time-saving tax filing experience. Paying taxes is how we come together to fund public services that Minnesotans value and count on, but with our current system, the majority of folks pay to meet their income tax filing responsibilities, and a free public filing option would be a better choice for many Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Ms. Mann, overall, you support the Davids bill?
I'm always looking for a chance to support a Davids bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, I think. Okay, so let's go to the virtual testifier, if we could. Mr. John Call with the Claw Tax Group, LLC.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to share my perspective today, especially virtually. during a busy time of year here. My name is John Call. I'm a federally licensed enrolled agent and managing partner of Claw Tax Group in White Bear Lake. I represent a broad cross-section of taxpayers and serve as a member of the Minnesota Chapter of Enrolled Agents. And I'm also co-chair of the Government Relations Committee for our National Association, the National Association of Enrolled Agents. I'm here today to respectfully oppose HF 2437, specifically the provision that would impose sales tax on accounting, tax preparation, and taxpayer representation. At its core, this measure adds a new tax burden to a service that helps Minnesotans comply with the law. Expanding the sales tax base to include tax compliance services may seem like a revenue-generating move, but in practice, it discourages professional assistance and erodes voluntary compliance. Taxpayers already facing financial strain will be the first to reconsider whether or not they can afford expert help. This leads to preventable mistakes, missed refunds, and a drop in overall compliance, which ironically may reduce state revenue in the long run. It's also worth noting who will be most affected. Many of our clients are seniors, immigrants, day laborers, and low-income families, the very taxpayers who seem to be increasingly targeted by the Minnesota Department of Revenue. These individuals rely on us to help resolve disputes and navigate complex issues with both the IRS and the state. Here's an additional concern. While Minnesota doesn't require citizens to hire a tax professional, our state's code is complex enough that more than half of Minnesotans do. So this proposal essentially taxes Minnesotans for doing the responsible thing, seeking help to comply with the law. This creates what I believe is a structural conflict of interest. The more difficult the tax code becomes, the more people need help, and the more the state profits from taxing that help. It amounts to a penalty for compliance, even if it's not really called one. And if the concern is lost revenue, let me raise another point. With federal credentials, professionals like me can serve clients anywhere. If Minnesota taxes these services, many taxpayers will seek out help in neighboring states where those same services are not taxed. That puts Minnesota-based businesses at a disadvantage. Taxing these services punishes the very people trying to do the right thing. I appreciate your time today and ask you to consider the broader consequences of this policy change. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Call. Let's go to Mr. Brian Lake, and then Mr. Gino Fragnito, and then Mr. Brian Cook. So please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Lake. I represent the Minnesota State Bar Association. The bar is very concerned about the proposed sales tax on consumer legal services, which we think will be extremely harmful to low-income and average-income Minnesotans. So who are these people? Well, they're the abused person who's trying to seek an order for protection that might save their life. It's the adult child who's trying to protect an aging parent from a predatory caretaker. It's the single parent trying to collect delinquent child support that they desperately need to provide food, clothing, and shelter for their children. These are the kinds of everyday situations that Minnesotans need to deal with. Legal services are not a luxury. And I want to briefly cover some other types of cases where I think the application of this tax would be particularly unfair. For example, evictions, foreclosures, and contract for deed terminations, where this bill would tax people who are trying to keep from losing their homes. Employment disputes like wrongful termination, discrimination, sexual harassment, where people will have to pay a tax in order to expose misconduct and seek justice. Debt collection cases. Now, these are often brought against people who are being sued for outdated or erroneous debts, often due to identity theft. This bill would tax people who are just trying to avoid having their credit destroyed and their wages garnished for a debt they might not even owe. Now, these cases are actually worse than they sound because all of these case types that I described and many others involve an individual in litigation against an entity. And because this would be a consumer-only tax, the entity would not have to pay taxes on their legal fees in these disputes, but the individual would, even though in the vast majority of these cases, the entity will have far superior resources. And when there's a resource imbalance in litigation, it often leads to the under-resourced party having to either take a bad deal or just give up because they can't afford to continue the fight. So really the only effect of this bill in these David versus Goliath legal battles is to make Goliath 10 feet tall instead of 9. Now, these dynamics are also present in cases brought by the government against individuals, where this bill is going to produce a rather absurd result where an individual will have to pay a tax to the government in order to defend themselves against the government, even when the individual prevails, and even if the matter was initiated because of a government mistake. So these cases can include criminal allegations where the government's trying to take your liberty, occupational licensure where they're trying to take your livelihood, eminent domain and asset forfeiture cases where they're trying to take your property, deportation, where your right to live in this country is at risk. Child protection, where your parental rights could be terminated.
Mr. Lake, if you wrap it up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a thorough letter in your packet that goes through some of these issues and many others. Mr. Chair, there are only three states that tax legal services, and I think it'd be a great mistake to make Minnesota the fourth.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. Let's go to Mr. Fragnito.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Gino Fragnito, and I'm the Government Relations Director at the Minnesota CPA Society. We're a member organization of over 7,000 CPAs working across all sectors of the economy, including nonprofit, education, and government. And we're opposed to the proposed tax on accounting services and other services found in House File 2437. Sales tax on services is regressive and bad tax policy. Extending a sales tax to services will affect those who need accounting services to perhaps claim a refund they're entitled to. One example might be a senior citizen on fixed income who must now file an income tax return to claim the renter's credit. Minnesota now requires filing an income tax return to claim the credit, even if the individual falls below the threshold for filing an income tax return. Also, the language included in the bill, including but not limited to, is overly broad, leaves too much to interpretation or one's imagination, and tips the scales even further in the government's favor. You heard earlier that the wording is the dream for a state auditor to be able to include anything and everything in an audit. That same dream is a tax professional's nightmare as they are left wondering what should be taxed and what an auditor might do. We have a voluntary compliance system that grows more complex each year. Taxing someone to comply with the law adds to the complexity and increases the cost of complying. As you consider the proposal, I'd ask you to keep a few things in mind. A simple tax return could cost $350. And if I use the 9.8 sales tax rate in St. Paul, someone would see an increase of about $35 just for that simple tax return. Figures from the Department of Revenue we heard earlier indicate the average household will save $32. I'm not sure what was used to define average, but if the state sales tax rate is reduced from 6.875 to 6.8%, that savings would be $7.50 on $10,000 in taxable purchases. So the average taxpayer would need to make approximately $50,000 in taxable purchases to save that $32 per year to break even with the tax or the tax increase generated by the new sales tax return. One final point I'd like to call your attention to is the list of services specifically listed and included for the accounting language are audit, bookkeeping, financial statement preparation, payroll, and tax return preparation services. The first four services are purchased, if not entirely, mostly by businesses. If the intent is to exempt business purchases, why do we have business taxes included in the language? According to data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, 91% of accounting services are purchased by either businesses, government, or nonprofits, leaving 9% purchased by consumers, and it would be unreasonable to impose a new sales tax on the consumption of a service people only purchase because the government forces them to comply with a different, inherently complex tax, the income tax. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Fragnito. Mr. Cook.
Chair Davids, members of the House Taxes Committee, my name is Brian Cook. I'm the Director of Tax, Fiscal Policy, and Elections for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Chamber is a statewide organization representing more than 6,300 businesses of all sizes in all industries who employ more than 500,000 employees in our state. We support policies that best position our state for future success by advancing a competitive business climate to encourage a growing economy. This morning, I'd like to share our views on House File 2437, the Governor's Tax Budget. I'd like to draw your attention to the Business Coalition letter regarding the expanded sales tax proposal, which we oppose, and to reiterate our support for the proposal on sustainable aviation fuel that was heard as part of Chair David's House File 1669. But mostly today, I would like to speak about our support for the state's research and development tax credit enhancement. The governor's proposal for 25% refundability on the R&D credit will be a meaningful step forward for attracting investment in innovation and fostering job growth and retention. According to the latest data available through the National Science Foundation's Business Enterprise Research and Development Report, in 2022, companies invested over $8.1 billion on R&D activities in Minnesota, corresponding to 43,000 R&D jobs. 75% of those expenses come from manufacturing industries led by medical equipment, electronic products, transportation, machinery, and food. Minnesota was a nation leader in fostering these investments by being the first state to enact an R&D tax credit over 40 years ago, but since then nearly 40 states have their own credit with over a dozen of them utilizing some fashion of refundability or transferability. Recent economic data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis and the State Science and Technology Institute illustrates our competitiveness situation. Minnesota ranks 16th among the states in private R&D value, but 45th in R&D growth over a five-year rolling period. We rank 12th in total patents, but 46th in new patent growth. This proposal can help Minnesota accelerate its growth in those areas. A working paper published by the National Bureau of Economic Research in 2019 notes that, quote, over the long term, R&D tax credits empower regions to significantly increase both the quantity of entrepreneurship and the number of expected growth outcomes. Counties with R&D tax credits experience a rise in the rate of new firm formation and the number of expected growth outcomes by 2% per year, 20% over a 20-year period. The 25% refundability proposal will help our state regain a competitive edge so that Minnesota employers can reinvest resources into furthering innovation, hiring, and retaining top talent. I also want to note our appreciation to Commissioner Marquardt for his efforts on this proposal as well. So thank you for your consideration on this.
And thank you very much, Mr. Cook. I think what we'll do is we'll start with some comments from Chair Gomez. And then we'll go to member questions, and then Chair Gomez will also have a wrap-up also. So, Chair Gomez.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Mr. Chair. I just had a couple of questions. They're maybe for the commissioner, but maybe for our staff.
Commissioner Marker, why don't you join us at the table here? I've got a feeling there'll be a couple questions for you. And thank you, I thank everyone who testified. When we do a governor's bill like this, it's been tradition. I think it's a good tradition where the chair of the party opposite carries the bill. And so I'm carrying the bill, and we're giving it a full hearing today. So I want to thank the governor for presenting his bill. He's done his job. And then the committee, of course, will do our job too. So Chair Gomez.
Thanks. The aeronautics revenue restructure that you talked about, I think that was a new item from the supplemental budget, Commissioner?
Commissioner Marquardt.
No, it was not, but it was not included in the tax portion the first time I came here. It was added late.
Okay.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, okay, that makes sense why it's new to me. I'm just wondering if it's on the fiscal spreadsheet or not. No?
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, the aeronautical provision in the governor's bill is a jurisdictional issue. It is being tracked in the Transportation Finance Committee.
Thank you, Ms. Templin. Chair Gomez.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Maybe we can just get some information about what the fiscal impact is of that item, if it's kind of in both places. There's a lot of, we give a lot of tax benefits to airports, aeronautics entities in our code that I'm kind of just feel like I keep coming across them in different places, so I'm interested in having a more comprehensive view of that. So I'd appreciate some follow-up on that one. Just to clarify, the sustainable forestry payments go to companies, not to governmental entities, because we kind of are thinking of, we're talking about it in this kind of section about aids to local governments, but just to clarify, the sustainable forestry payments go to like lumber companies, logging companies, forest product processing companies. Is that true?
Commissioner Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members, I do think they can go to governmental entities. I believe a tribal nation has been impacted by this reduction also.
Okay.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you for that, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so those are just kind of a couple of like clarifying questions. I mean, in general, I think the governor is bringing forward some provisions that I agree with and others that I don't. We've had a you know, we've had conversation about this bill before, sort of, you know, talking about the increasing the R&D credit. The refundability of the R&D credit is of particular concern because that's basically sending checks to corporations that have no tax liability in Minnesota, checks that are paid for by the, you know, out of the public coffers. And we have are having a lot of conversations across state government at this point about, you know, in Chair Robbins' committee about sort of how are we tracking sending the people's money out the door. And I believe that we need to apply the same rigor to sending the people's money out the door to the biggest corporations in the world as we do to, like, small local nonprofits, which are receiving a lot of scrutiny right now. I would like to see, you know, if we're going to have, there have been conversations in many committees about, hey, why are we giving public money to this entity where their executive is making five times what the governor makes? That's kind of a crazy, you know, that idea of using scarce public dollars to support an organization like that. Well, we're using scarce public dollars in tax committee every day to subsidize and send money to entities where the executives make 100 times what the governor makes or more. And so, you know, I want us, as we're thinking about being prudent with the public dollar, which we all need to do, to apply some of those same ideas that we hear in other committees to our work here in the tax committee. I just wanted to talk about one item on this in this package, and it's the auditors, which are, it's like page 2 on line 12, and I wonder if I could ask Ms. Templin, because I know this is an item that is carried in the state gov bill. These numbers that we're seeing here are just different than the most recent ones that I've seen, because usually, like with these auditors, there will be a first year or first biennium cost and then a revenue gain in the planning biennium. And so that kind of can give you an idea of what the return on investment is for compliance initiatives at the Department of Revenue. And so
Chair Gomez, are you on page 2, line 12?
Yeah, yep, of the spreadsheet from House Fiscal. Okay. And so I wonder if you can just talk us through what the cost of that is and what the sort of return on investment for that cost is.
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, yes. In your spreadsheet, you will see starting on page 2, line 11, is the line 12 is the establish a pass-through audit. And the line that you see there is the revenue gain, the estimated revenue gain for establishing the pass-through audit unit. And this is the estimated revenue gain from the hiring of, I believe, 13 auditors. And it is an estimated revenue gain of $1.1 million in fiscal 27, starting in fiscal 27, and then the revenue increases or is projected to increase in fiscal 28 and 29. There is an appropriation that goes along with this proposal that the governor has, and it is the governor proposes an appropriation, and that appropriation is carried on the tax expenditure side of this spreadsheet, and that is on page 6, line 36, and it Ms. Highmark may want to also provide more information about this, but there's an appropriation of $692 million that begins in fiscal 26, and that appropriation grows to $1.4 million in fiscal 27, and it is ongoing. And again, this is for the operational cost to hire auditors. So the difference between the revenue and the expenditures is the net gain is there's an estimated net gain for the two of $1.7 million in fiscal 28 and $2.7 million in fiscal 29.
Thank you.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just wanted to focus on this for a moment because, you know, I, like everyone, read, you know, the national press, and I'm reading about what's happening at the IRS. You know, there's basically there are leaked memos and emails saying that the intention of this administration is to cut the personnel working at the IRS by 50%. We already have seen thousands of, you know, sort of provisional workers and their positions not renewed. There's estimates that I've read that it's called high wealth something, a division within the IRS that is really focused on making sure that high wealth individuals pay the money that they owe into the public coffers, and their since the beginning of the year, their complement has been reduced by a third. And so what we see happening in our government right now, and you need only look at what happened in Wisconsin yesterday. I mean, we have a government that we have basically given over to billionaires. And billionaires would love to see the IRS completely dissolved. And they're who benefit when we don't have auditors and compliance initiatives focusing on corporate and complex and high wealth returns. There are estimates already that given the erosion of IRS staffing, that revenue, this is just like without anything further happening, that revenue collection in our country could be down by 10%. And this is like exactly the world that, you know, the people who the kind of Elon Musks and Mark Zuckerbergs and all the guys standing behind the president at the inauguration that they want to live in. And, you know, so in light of that, I mean, when we look at this, right, we're seeing at least a 2-to-1 return on investment in auditors. And, you know, what I learned when I was working on a compliance initiative a few years ago was that especially with corporate and complex returns, the Department of Revenue relies on our partners at the IRS for so much of the information that allows us to recoup money that is owed to the people of Minnesota by corporations and the wealthy. We rely on the IRS having, you know, an operational auditing function. And the people who this benefits, the people who the erosion of the IRS's ability to make sure that billionaires and corporations are paying what they owe, the beneficiaries of that are these people who are shirking their taxes. And so I just have a lot of concern about what's happening federally, and I feel really strongly that, like, this is the kind of thing, these compliance initiatives, when you put a dollar in, you get two or three out. And, you know, and as that ability at the federal level is eroded, we as states have to step up more. And so, you know, in light of our financial situation, I just think taking a look at compliance initiatives is really something that we have to take seriously, regardless of, you know, what your sort of political orientation is. It's like, you know, the fact of the matter is that the people who are benefiting from this erosion of the capacity at the federal level and what will happen to our capacity to do compliance at the state level are, you know, people who are, you know, are shirking their taxes. And it's, you know, we focus these compliance initiatives on, you know, sort of these complex returns. It's like regular people who make a wage, we can't cheat on our taxes because all the information just gets sent to the IRS and gets sent to the Department of Revenue at the state. So I just wanted to discuss that compliance initiative piece, and appreciate the chance, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. You mentioned leaks. I want to report to the press and all the members that there have been no leaks from the Gomez-Davids Committee.
We run a tight ship, Mr. Chair.
We do. You're not going to get anything out of us. Okay, questions from members?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Commissioner Marquardt, for presenting today, and Chair. Thank you, Chair. Yes, I have one question, specifically when it was just for the expansion of the sales tax real quick. It said credit card fees were going to be taxed. Does that mean the fees that that the credit card company charges if somebody goes in to buy something and they use their credit card, and the fee that gets charged to the bank, or what fees are you talking about?
Commissioner Marquardt?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, so I think I mentioned ATM fees, but I don't remember saying anything about credit card, but that's been brought up before, and assumption is no, that type of thing would not be taxed that you just mentioned.
Mr.
Representative Johnson?
It's just on page 16 when it's banking and brokerage services. It says safety deposit boxes, credit card fees, loan servicing, payment services, and stuff like that. So I guess I'm just trying to get back to what would generate these credit card fees.
So
Commissioner Marquardt?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, thank you. Yeah, no. So what that would be is, like, at my bank, I've got a credit card, and to get that, they could charge a fee. They don't in my bank, but that's what we're talking about there. It's just the banking actually to get the card. There could be a fee in processing, or if I have to replace my card, there could be a fee for that. That's what we're talking about here, not the exchange or the, you know, with the using it and so forth.
Okay, thank you. One more, just follow up.
Yeah, but Commissioner Marquardt, sounds like you got a pretty good bank. it really does. Yeah. Representative Johnson.
Just one more comment, just because, again, as brought up by our friends at MICA and AMC regarding the challenges being put on counties. I know they didn't bring it up because it's, relatively speaking, aquatic invasion species, but it's still a cost to back through. I'm interested in how you can say the governor supports something, but he doesn't want to pay for something anymore. I mean, because I heard that say, don't get me wrong, he still supports it, but we want to cut what we pay for that by half. And it's just another addition of put money in one pocket, take it out of the other, and saying it's a cut. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Do you want to respond to that, Commissioner? Or?
Mr. Chair, at the very end, if I could have some concluding comments.
Oh, absolutely. You will, and yes. Chair Gomez also will. Okay, let's go to Representative Wiener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple points of clarification, and maybe this more goes to Mr. Horton. When it comes to the sustainable forest, there was a question about, is this public or business versus private? And my understanding is, and maybe you can clarify, that landowners, private landowners, qualify for this just as well. Is that correct?
Mr. Horton?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wiener, that is correct. Private landowners, any private landowner can enroll in the program as long as they've got 20 acres of land. And, you know, by numbers, that is the most enrollees are private landowners. By acres, we've got two corporate entities, Mulpus and Land and Paper Company, that have enrolled their land. And if you have more than 1,920 acres, you have to allow public access. So those are two, you know, vastly huge properties that the public recreates on. There's a lot of trails going through there, a lot of hunting activity and that sort of thing.
Representative Wiener?
So it would have a very big impact on private owners then.
That's correct.
Mr. Horton?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wiener. Yes. Disproportionate effect on the private landowners themselves. A lot of those folks use that money to help pay their property taxes. That helps keep the forested lands forested.
Representative Wiener.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, and thank you for your answers there. In a different note, kind of off of what was said before, was the shifting burdens to counties. We've seen the increase, and I'm sure Mr. Marquardt knows the numbers very well, the Minnesota Miracle back in 71. Actually, I've heard you refer to it. You know, and at that time, we went from a property tax that was funding our state government to somewhere around 40%. With the change in PILT and other programs here, it's shifting of funds, or revenue rather, to the counties. What is going to be the percentage that the counties are going to be responsible for as far as our budget?
Commissioner?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Weider, that's an excellent question. And so, first of all, I want to give you a little context. I mean, the governor, as he looked at trying to solve the budget structural deficit, was looking, trying to keep off the table county program aid and local government aid, things that funded essential services like public safety and so forth. He also wanted to avoid anything that is a direct property tax relief, so the homestead credit or the renter's credit, which is like another $1 billion, keep that off the table. So looked at other areas and looked for the counties, and I will say that the state auditor reports every year on finances, and in the 2024 report for counties, counties in 2024 received $2.4 billion in either categorical or general purpose aid, $2.4 billion. And if you take the homestead credit refund and the renter's credit, which goes directly to all county residents, that's another $1 billion a year. So it's about $3.4 billion a year, either going directly to counties or directly to their citizens that the state is paying for. So the governor felt that the counties could have a share in this. And so what is that share, what you're getting? So the numbers are, and we can provide this to the committee in detailed, is so for the first biennium, it's about $180 million of share now will be assumed by the counties. And in the next biennium, it's $346 million, which is about $173 million a year. So if you take that $3.4 billion that we know is going out from the state, that $173 million is about 5.1%. That'd be about the context the governor's looking at. If all of that $173 million had to go on property tax, if, and there's no reason it has to, but if it did, right now, in the 2025 levies, the counties levied $4.2 billion. So that $173 million would be about 4.1% levy. So it doesn't minimize the impact, but the counties do receive a good share of funding from the state. And the governor, as he's looking at trying to make this work, and this is not easy. The governor's always had great relations with the counties, including the increases, the county programming, and so forth, but thought it was fair for the counties to share in some of this. So I'm not saying whether or not the 5% or the 4% is high or low. It's just to give you some context of what the governor looked at in his kind of decision-making process as he looked at trying to solve this very difficult budget.
Representative Weider?
And I think the good comparison would be the amount of unfunded mandates that would have gone back to the counties over the last biennium, especially, and now this one, plus more shifting. So even if the counties are getting more money, but also burdened with more unfunded mandates, I think that would be a better comparison if we're going to get numbers on that in the future. And then I know we're running out of time, so just two other quick things. Reminds me, you know, when we look at this bill and some of the comments earlier, snowmobiling a number of years ago and stopping at a bar buying pull tab on a meat raffle, and there's sayings on the back of it. And I've saved it. It's actually in my wallet, but I think it's very accurate at this time. It says a penny saved is a government oversight. And, you know, in this current tax bill, when we're adding more and more taxes onto services and everything else, I'm just wondering at what point are we running out of things to tax? That's more of a statement than a comment, I guess. But the other question I had is for the chair. When one of the testifiers, I believe was Robert Hanton, asked the said about retirement, and the chair said at 70, would that be considered financial advice, and should we be collecting taxes on that, mm-hmm. that financial advice?
Oh, I play penny. I pay plenty. Very quickly, Representative Lee or Freiberg? Representative Freiberg.
Sure.
And then we'll go to Chair.
Thank
Bowman.
You. Yeah, I know we're just about out of time, so I will just make this a comment that's very brief, but as the chair of the Elections Committee, I sort of feel obligated to mention it. You know, this proposed budget has many admirable things in it, but one thing I have concerns with is the repeal of the political contribution refund program. That program has been very critical in getting in helping to reduce, not getting rid of, but helping to reduce the impact of big money in our elections and helping small donors, individuals get involved in the political process. I feel like when we have a billionaire trying to buy an election in the state next door to us, it's never been more important to have programs like this in place. So I'm hopeful that, you know, as this discussion moves forward, we can look at other areas for budget savings rather than repeal of the political contribution refund program.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. I was thinking about asking the Sergeant Arms to cover the clocks. It used to be a very important technique. The last person I have on the list is Representative Anderson, and then we're going to go to Chair Gomez and the Commissioner.
I'll be very, very quick. I have a specific question on the estate tax, because I noticed that I was just trying to do the math, but it looks like the governor is essentially saying that estate taxes are going to drop by about 20%, 17% on the spreadsheet.
Commissioner, or maybe Ms. Templin?
So,
is that...
Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't have that. I don't know quite.
Let's go to Ms. Templin, or maybe we can follow up with that, Representative Anderson.
On the spreadsheet?
Madam Chair, Representative.
Line 33?
Yes. That line 33 of the spreadsheet shows current law forecasted revenues for estate taxes. The provisions that are governor's recommendations are highlighted in gray.
Right.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. So the spreadsheet assumes that the estate tax is going to drop about, I don't have math, 15 to 20% next biennium. Is that correct?
According to the spreadsheet? Madam, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, the spreadsheet is showing the forecast for the 24-25 biennium is $629.9 million for estate taxes. And then, yes, there is a reduction, an estimated projected reduction of $551.1 million in the fiscal 26-27 biennium.
Thank you. So thank I don't think less people are passing away. I think we are chasing people out of the state, and this is another example of that. So we are losing revenue overall because we are chasing people out of the state. So thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Anderson. To wrap it up, let's go with Chair Gomez.
We're kind of over time. I'll just you know, some things are good, some things are bad, like any bill, and we'll look forward to having more discussions as we move forward with passing a budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and I would just say that I want to thank the governor. If you would thank the governor for his budget proposal, and thank you for your presentation. As always, you're very well-versed, but before you wrap it up, let's give the commissioner a chance to wrap it up. Somebody mentioned 1971. Who won the World Series and who did they beat? Come on, Commissioner.
Boy, Mr. Chair, it was the A's in 72, 73, and 74. So
that's not what I asked.
And it was the Pirates in 70 over the Cincinnati in the Cincinnati.
1971, Pittsburgh in seven games beat Baltimore.
Yes.
They're pretty close, pretty close. So if you could please wrap it up, sir.
Yeah, no, just... Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and members, thank you so much for hearing this. And I'll just focus on the sales tax expansion. So this is a very serious, it's a very kind of incremental plan. And if we're ever going to really look at kind of expanding the base, lowering the rate, we have to do that. Mark Haveman wrote something in Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence, said the odds of this passing back in February was 26-1 because there was 26 bills that narrowed the base and only one that expanded the base, this one. And so we know when you're narrowing the base, it just puts the pressure on increasing more or higher rate on a more regressive tax. Despite everything that was heard, this will move it more progressive, less regressive. And if we're ever going to kind of take a serious look, it's not easy because everyone – you know, is impacted. But if we're going to be serious about really looking at improving the tax code and making a difference here and then trying to expand it, this is, I think, would be a good start. But thank you so much for taking the time today. Great debate.
And thank you, Commissioner. I'll renew my motion that House File 2437 as going to be included in the omnibus tax bill. Anything else for the good of the order? good government all the time. We are adjourned.